Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Is Major League Baseball on the verge of yet another full-blown PED scandal? Ahead on Only a Game, baseball investigates players allegedly associated with the defunct Biogenesis Lab. Also, the Spurs go for NBA title number 5, and fabled horse track Hollywood Park prepares to shut down after a 75-year run. Also ahead, two doctors, sort of. Doc Emrick discusses the challenges of hockey play-by-play, and former Major League ace Dwight Doc Gooden discusses his addiction and recovery.
Which should have been the highlight of my baseball career, clinching the World Series and celebrating my teammates. I found myself partying all night, drinking, drugging. I spent the rest of that day by myself just sobbing all day.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game is provided by Oliver Wyman. Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals serving global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Without throwing a pitch or swinging a bat, Tony Bosch grabbed baseball headlines this week when Bosch, who ran the now-defunct clinic called Biogenesis in Florida, agreed to cooperate with Major League Baseball's investigation of players alleged to have acquired performance-enhancing drugs from him. The biggest names on that list are the Yankees' Alex Rodriguez and Ryan Braun of the Milwaukee Brewers. Joining me is Mike Fish, one of the three writers who broke this story for ESPN's Outside the Lines. Mike, welcome to Only a Game.
Hey, thank you, Bill.
Why did Tony Bosch, who had previously denied doing anything illegal, suddenly agree this week to cooperate with Major League Baseball's investigation into the Biogenesis Clinic?
Major League Baseball brought a civil lawsuit against Tony Bosch. The Florida Department of Health is also considering action against him, as are possibly some criminal charges from South Florida. Basically, baseball has agreed in conversations with Mr. Bosch's attorney to drop the civil lawsuit and also indemnify him and speak on his behalf if there are any criminal charges brought against him. I suspect that he was kind of pushed into a corner, if you will, by Major League Baseball and their investigative unit, and he and his attorneys have seen that as perhaps his best way out of this.
There has been lots of discussion of possible suspensions for the 20 or more players allegedly associated with Biogenesis. Assuming Bosch's testimony implicates players, can those players be suspended absent positive drug tests?
Yeah, they can. There's a clause in the drug agreement they have that talks about non-analytic positive tests. In other words, if they have documentation or evidence of a player being involved with performance-enhancing drugs, they can be suspended. Assuming they have the proper evidence, if they have records, documentation, and confirmation from Bosch and perhaps other associates of this transpiring, they could make that case. Obviously, the Player Association would challenge that, so it may end up in arbitration, and it could be a drawn-out process.
What's your best guess about when we might hear about some suspensions and then when those suspensions might actually go into effect?
Well, it would only be a guess. I mean, we're talking now about, you know, Tony Bosch meeting with Major League Baseball and sharing information and sharing documents. And Major League Baseball obviously is attempting to get confirmation through documents, be it phone records, credit card receipts, shipping records, and all that kind of stuff. You're talking about really important stuff here. I mean, in the grand scheme of things, you're looking at baseball contracts for players in some cases, be it A-Rod or Ryan Braun, that are in tens of millions of dollars. So to just unilaterally suspend them is going to be very difficult. And for baseball to make that action, they're going to have all their I's dotted and T's crossed. And then I'm sure that the Players Association will seek whatever recourse they have. So it's going to be months.
It may be premature to talk about the potential of the Biogenesis case to create the biggest scandal of Major League Baseball's so-called steroid era, but people have been talking about it that way. Have they got it right?
Potentially they do, yeah. If we're talking 20-plus players, and we don't know if there's more players whose names haven't been reported yet, and if indeed baseball sought to suspend that many, that obviously would be unprecedented. The other thing that's really important to point out here is that this case is different. If you go back to Balco, if you go back with Kirk Radomski, the former Mets clubhouse attendant, which are two of the prior major cases,
mm-hmm.
and which both brought up a whole lot of names. Both of those situations were precipitated by investigations from law enforcement. This here is different because law enforcement is not involved yet. To this point, it's been entirely driven by Major League Baseball and its investigative unit. That's what makes it kind of interesting.
With T.J. Quinn and Pedro Gomez, Mike Fish has been investigating Tony Bosch's Biogenesis Clinic for ESPN's Outside the Lines. Mike, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
The NBA Finals tipped off on Thursday night with LeBron James and the defending champion Miami Heat hosting the San Antonio Spurs after a 9-day hiatus in the wake of their 4-game sweep of the Memphis Grizzlies in the Western Conference Finals. The Spurs showed no signs of rust in Game 1. They topped Miami 92-88. Joining me now from Miami to discuss the series is Howard Beck, who covers the NBA for the New York Times. Howard, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks for having me.
The Miami Heat entered Game 1 as heavy favorites, but the Spurs took away the home court advantage. They lead the series 1-0. What happened?
Tony Parker happened. He scored 10 points in the fourth quarter and was fantastic and hit one of the most amazing, unlikely circus shots after a circus possession, really. You know, it was funny because when someone asked LeBron in the press conference, hey, take us through that, and he says, really? You want me to? You're going to make me live that again? The other thing that happened was that the Heat, who are pretty precise in crunch time, generally speaking, and especially in playoff games, really kind of came apart.
LeBron James, meanwhile, put up 18 points. He had 18 rebounds and 10 assists as well. What does he have to do for Miami to win, even more than that?
He had a fabulous game in a lot of respects. It was a fairly quiet triple-double, I have to say. You know, 18, 18, and 10 is never anything to sniff at, and I think most nights that LeBron puts up numbers like that, the Heat are probably going to win. But it wasn't a dominant game, and they also just did not get enough from everyone else. Going 5 for 18 with 5 turnovers in the fourth quarter is not going to win too many games in the NBA Finals.
San Antonio forward Tim Duncan won his first NBA title back in 1999, his most recent championship in 2007, and now at the age of 37, he's 3 wins away from a 5th ring. How does he keep it up?
Tim Duncan's kept himself in fantastic shape and for the most part hasn't had the kind of serious injuries over the course of his career that might derail some of the great players. So credit him for keeping himself in great condition for the most part, but also just, again, having that great fundamental game that just has never gone away. And he's got great players around him.
All right, Howard, we've reached the point where I ask you the inevitable question. Do the Spurs keep it up and win their 5th championship, or does the Heat make it 2 in a row?
Well, I thought this series was a toss-up from the moment we knew what the series was. Because I thought the Heat, they're not last year's Heat. Wade is dealing with a sore knee. So I wasn't, so sure about the Heat. And I have a lot of faith in the Spurs in general and what they do because they've always just been that kind of team that will not shoot themselves in the foot. So I picked the Spurs in 7 at the start. I clearly have no reason to change that pick. I do think we will see much more from the Heat to come. This will be a competitive series. I still see the Spurs winning this in 6 or 7.
Howard Beck covers the NBA for the New York Times. Howard, thank you very much for joining me.
My pleasure, Bill. Thanks for having me.
Even as many in the horse racing world focused on this weekend's 145th running of the Belmont Stakes at Belmont Park, some were thinking about the demise of another track that's been a cornerstone of the horse racing industry. Hollywood Park in Inglewood, California, will hang up its reins for good in December. Susan Vallett has the story.
In front of a backdrop of palm trees and pink flamingos, jockeys maneuver into the starting gates. Race fans place their bets.
I mean, $1 exacto box, 1, 3, and 4.
But the last post is coming soon. The 238-acre track will close in December after a 75-year run. It's a victim of rising California property values and declining attendance at races. The track will be replaced by 3,000 homes, retail space, and a hotel. Track regular Lorenzo Manuel calls it a travesty.
This is the backbone. It's been here for so long, you know. And like race fans, you know, come out here, and this is a tradition. You know what I mean? You're killing a tradition.
Jack and Harry Warner of Hollywood's Warner Brothers fame founded Hollywood Park in 1938. It became the track of the stars. A-list shareholders included Walt Disney, crooner Bing Crosby, and entertainer Al Jolson. Hollywood Park president Jack Lebo says the track became the first ever to offer Sunday racing, Friday night racing, and exotic wagers that are now at tracks everywhere.
Well, the exacta, the pick six, the superfecta, you name it, and it probably started at Hollywood Park.
In the early 1980s, Hollywood Park could attract 80,000 fans. Now, attendance is a trickle of that, leaving the stands largely empty. Bill Branch is a horse owner.
You know, it's really quite sad to come out here on a Thursday or a Friday, and three-quarters of the stands are just roped off. When I was a kid and I would come here with my dad, we would sit up in the far banks of left field, and it was completely crowded.
Track president Jack Lebo says in California, racing's been hurt by the prevalence of Indian casinos, which are the only venues in the state that have slot machines. Hollywood Park has a casino, but no slots. Satellite wagering and online wagering, originally intended to boost interest in horse racing, ended up siphoning off fans who'd come to the track regularly, like Richard Inofuku, who used to come here every weekend. Now he just bets and watches from home.
When you come out here, it's like this, empty. There's no excitement. When you get 80,000 people like before, I mean, it just gets you all worked up, and your juice gets flowing. Here, it's so empty that I may as well be at home.
Horse trainer Roger Karayan, who's been in the industry for 42 years, says part of the problem is that horse racing isn't in the public eye as much as it used to be.
Years ago, you used to get race calls on the radios on the stretch call with Bill Gar. Okay. That thing disappeared. It used to be on the TV every night, the race replays. That's gone.
Karayan says the closure of Hollywood Park is going to help kill the racing industry. He points out the track is a key training facility for thoroughbreds, and without it, they won't have as many places to get their legs. About 1,200 to 1,500 horses are stabled at the track. They'll have to find new homes. Horse owner Bill Branch cheers on one of his horses. Branch says despite the closure of Hollywood Park, he thinks horse racing can still pull ahead.
You know, they could talk about on-site attendance, but like when Zenyatta was racing here, it was packed. I mean, what we really need is you know, essentially a LeBron James of horse racing. That's really what horse racing needs. And the next generation of superstars will come. They just need to give it time, but unfortunately there's going to be no time here.
Come on, baby. Pounce on him. Pounce on him, baby. Pounce on him.
Hollywood Park's last race runs December 22nd. For Only a Game, I'm Susan Vallett in Los Angeles.
To check out Susan Vallett's Fetching Hollywood Park pictures, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. It's no surprise that British sprinter Adam Gemelli accepted a challenge from another runner. Athletes compete, and when a fellow sprinter named Brian tweeted Gemelli to propose a race, the battle was on for last weekend. Brian, which turns out to be a robot capable of covering 100 meters of track in 10 seconds, as long as the track is really a track, as in trolley track, nipped Gemelli at the wire, raised its mechanical arms over its metal box of a head, and shouted, "Winning!" Gemelli sheepishly acknowledged that Brian was quick. Then, I assume he went looking for a screwdriver with which to disassemble Brian before it could stick out its tongue and offer to run backwards in a rematch.
Build the robots. Just build the robots.
I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, two doctors with careers in sports. But first, on Friday night in Boston, the Bruins completed their sweep of the Pittsburgh Penguins in the NHL's Eastern Conference Finals. The Bruins have now reached the finals two out of the last 3 years. Pittsburgh was the last team to sweep the Eastern Semis, which they did against the Carolina Hurricanes in 2009. If you've watched these NHL playoffs or any of them over the last quarter century or so, you've no doubt heard this voice.
The drop comes to Kunitz, moving in to Crosby. Oh, and what a save! My goodness, what a save by Varlamov!
That voice belongs to Mike Emmerich, currently calling the Stanley Cup playoffs for NBC Sports. Some feel that Emmerich, better known as Doc, is one of the best play-by-play announcers working today, and he joins me in the studio. Doc Emmerich, welcome to Only a Game.
Bill, this is fun.
You did not grow up in a hockey hotbed, Detroit, Moose Jaw, Chicago, or Saskatoon. You're from a small town in Indiana. How and when did hockey enter your life?
December 10, 1960. After a lot of harassment, my parents took me and my brother to see a game in Fort Wayne, Indiana. And up until that time, I loved athletics, but I knew I wouldn't be a very good athlete. And I wanted to broadcast baseball because that was the only real exposure that we had listening on the radio to baseball games. But once I saw hockey for the first time, it was Muskegon and Fort Wayne in the old IHL, and that changed my life.
What are the particular challenges for calling hockey games as opposed to calling other sports?
I think seeing it, seeing and identifying players. Over a period of 40 years, I've felt that the plays that are made, especially defensively by players, are just as worthwhile as the attack by the offensive player. So I like to mention players' names who make plays, but the hardest thing now with some of the designs of uniforms is to be able to read the sleeve numbers. It's about 5.5 inches, and in some arenas, you are 250 feet away and 5 or 6 stories up. That's the challenge. The rest of it is like going to a movie the second time where you know all the characters. And the characters may change teams, but they usually don't change numbers. So that part is not really as hard as it looks.
In a recent article by Joe Posnanski, Al Michaels says that you're the best there is and that hockey is the toughest game of all to call. Do you think that's true?
I don't. I don't want to disagree with Al. He said some really nice things about me before, too. But I think that hockey has mostly continuous description. We don't have to wait for players to unpile. We don't have that interminable wait between pitches. And even in basketball, there are a lot of timeouts. But in hockey, there aren't many, except for our commercials. And so it's describing continuous action. So I don't think it's as hard as the others. I did try baseball once only at Miami University, and I realized that you can only refer to which way the flag is blowing in center field a couple of times, not every inning.
In that same article, Bob Costas was quoted as saying, Doc can tell stories or relate an anecdote while the action is going on, which, according to Costas, no other sportscaster does at all. So here's a good example of that from a game you called this past winter when the NHL was experiencing a lockout.
McAsee wants to be a veterinarian one day, has hermit crabs as a pet, thrown on goal, score! Tremendous shot from Matty Box.
That, of course, is a game you called in Troy, Michigan, featuring 9 to 12-year-old girls. Is hockey just hockey from your perspective as a play-by-play guy?
It is, but that's one of the best nights I think I've ever spent in a rink because it was an activity for these girls. They had a lot of other things that they did in their lives, but they were really committed to being good hockey players for that night. And the veterinarian was just when she had two dogs, a cat, and the hermit crabs. And that's what stuck in my mind because I don't know that I could recognize a hermit crab. But she took care of them, and she said they need lettuce. But for that night, they were hockey players.
Doc, you've worked more than 3,000 hockey games, including 21 years of New Jersey Devils games, 24 years of NHL playoff games. Have you a favorite moment or three that you can share with us?
I suppose the most recent one that stands out in my mind was an overtime game that went double overtime, played between Boston and Pittsburgh, in which there were only 3 goals scored, 94 shots taken. A lot of shots didn't count as shots on goal because they hit the post. And the thing that struck me about the game was how the level of play raised as the game went on, and everyone was playing at the highest level that they could. Usually you'll have some that are not good and others that are playing really well. Everybody was playing solid.
It's fascinating to me how you had to reach back so far into your memory for that game.
Wasn't too long ago. And then I think the gold medal game between Canada and the United States will always stand out when Sidney Crosby scored on Ryan Miller in overtime.
How have the 2013 Stanley Cup playoffs stacked up against some of the others that you've called?
You know, it's hard to know because we've put so much, and I'm saying we, I have put so much emotional weight on this year because it looked like we weren't going to have one at all with our lockout. And so you recognize that in the regular season as well as in the playoffs that the players have just extended themselves beyond belief. They've let it all out there, and they leave it there, and then they somehow or other re-energize and come back after a day off and play another one of those magnificent games. I think that's the thing that struck me the most is the thing that we have to sell is the wonderful game and the players who are so skilled and so down to earth. I think in 40 years I've met 5 or 6 jerks. That's all. And they do that, and then they talk with us after, and they share with the fans, and they're just good people.
You know, it occurs to me that some of our listeners might be wondering about your nickname, Doc. You earned it. You have a PhD, although I presume it's not in hockey.
No, it's signs of a misspent youth, I guess. My parents were both teachers. They placed a value on education, and as I was trying to break into hockey, I continued to get advanced degrees, and I taught at a little school in western Pennsylvania called Geneva for 2 years and realized I could make $600 more a year at that time if I had a doctorate degree. So I applied at 2 places that had doctoral programs in broadcasting that also had campus stations that, oddly enough, were affiliated with NPR and also broadcast the college team's games. Michigan and Bowling Green, they both offered assistantships, and Bowling Green threw in the second periods of the Falcon home games because the guy who had been doing that graduated. And so I was lucky, and I finally got an air check instead of those games that were phantom games in Fort Wayne, and it was on the strength of that air check that I got my first job 40 years ago.
You have humbly said that you have never called a perfect game, and maybe that's true, but I would like to play a clip that I think just might be the perfect hockey call. It's from a game between New Jersey and Philadelphia back on December 10th, 1998.
Flip back right to Andrechuk. Fire! Save! Rebound in front! Left into McCain! Scramble! Andrechuk to McCain! Did he get it home? No! Scramble! In front of the line! Hit the post with the shot! Oh, baby! Stevens! Fire! Save!
You couldn't have done that call any better, could you?
No, I don't know. I remember the game, though. It was one of those comeback wins, and you walk away from the arena and you sort of joke to yourself, we had them all the way. But that wasn't the case.
Doc Emrick is the lead play-by-play announcer for NBC Sports NHL coverage, and he's the first announcer to be inducted into the Hockey Hall of Fame. Doc, thanks very much for coming in.
This has been a lot of fun, and I'm honored by the invitation. Thank you.
Doc, a memoir is a tough read. With Newsday columnist Ellis Hennekin, Dwight Doc Gooden has produced a chronicle of his decades-long struggle against self-destruction via drug and alcohol addiction. Happily, Gooden, a former Cy Young Award winner and MVP, is sober today. Dwight Gooden, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
Doc, a memoir begins with your failure to join your teammates in a celebration after the New York Mets had won the 1986 World Series, but tell us where you were the day of that celebratory parade and the night before it.
Which should have been the highlight of my baseball career at that point. Unfortunately, 3 hours after clinching the World Series and celebrating with my teammates, I found myself in a house in Projects in Long Island, partying all night, drinking, drugging, through the wee hours of night. My goal was to get a little bit of drugs and go back and join my teammates at a local bar. Obviously, I never made it out of that apartment. And I saw the sun come up and watching the parade, when the parade started on TV, that's basically what sobered me up. And that's when all the shame and the guilt and embarrassment came in and every negative thought that you can imagine going through my head. I spent the rest of that day, and you know, when I finally got the courage to drive home, in my apartment with the drapes closed, the sheds pool, and just basically by myself, just sobbing all day.
You were 19 years old when you joined the previously disappointing Mets back in 1984, and as it says in the book, and I'm quoting now, a whole lot of Mets fans thought the savior might be me. For a time, you pitched as if you could be that savior. From 84 to 86, you won 58 games, lost only 19. You led the league in strikeouts twice and in ERA once. I wonder if at that point you felt, hey, this is easy.
I didn't feel like it was easy, but I tell you what, I felt like I could be successful for a long time. I took a lot of pride in my work between starts and my preparation that I will go through with pitching coach Mel Stottlemyre as well as my dad, you know, back in Tampa. It was a situation where I felt like it was more so 85 or after the All-Star break in 84 where I felt like I truly belonged. But in 85, it was a situation where it almost felt like it was at a concert and I was the main event and everybody was there to see me. And unfortunately, the following year in 86, a lot of expectations, you know, from the media, myself, the organization, was overwhelming. And it just got to the point where it just became too much. And that's when the drugs and the alcohol became very, very demanding and useful, where I was basically medicating myself.
Regarding cocaine, you write in the book, quote, "It was love at first sniff." Tell us a little bit about how and where you began using the drug.
I had a cousin that basically was a drug dealer, and he also had women that worked for him on the street. I was at his place, and I was basically there to pick up some marijuana, and he said he had to go get it. He was all out. And as he left the house to go get it, I told him I'll wait here. It was two young ladies in one of the rooms at his place, barely dressed, and it was doing cocaine, and they was drinking. And they asked me to come join them. I said, no, I'd rather not, because at that time I couldn't imagine myself, you know, doing anything worse than marijuana, even though a drug is a drug. But, you know, they was doing it, and women was one of my weaknesses as well. So eventually they convinced me, and doing a couple lines, I had a couple of drinks. I tried it just to see what it was like, and unfortunately, it gave me a feel like I never felt before. It was a false feeling where I thought this is the way I always wanted to feel, and the rest was history.
Dwight, I remember speaking with you in the visitors' locker room at Fenway Park in 98 or 99. You were pitching for the Cleveland Indians at the time, and you said all the right things. Every day was a gift. You felt fortunate to be alive, let alone to be in the major league still. Were you fooling people like me in those days, or were you fooling yourself as well?
I was fooling myself, but at the time I said those things, that's where I was, and it was a gift, and I was feeling great. Unfortunately, you know, my track record has been, once I get the clean time in, I'll start cutting back on the things that I'm supposed to do. Those things are basically my treatment. Like, if you had cancer, you get chemo. Having the disease of drugs and alcohol, my treatment is the sponsor, the meetings, the support group. I always start cutting back on that. And when I start cutting back on that, it's just a matter of time before I'm going to relapse. And it happened so many times, and unfortunately it took a lot of beatings to me and self-destruction that, you know, now I have to accept that as part of my life, and that's just the way it is on a daily basis.
According to the book, you didn't embrace sobriety until 2011. Why were you able to take advantage of participation on the TV program Celebrity Rehab when you hadn't allowed all those previous rehab programs to work?
I think the thing that really helped me was removing that mask from myself and being honest with myself and coming clean with myself and admitting that I am an addict. I'm just not an active addict. I do have the disease of alcohol and drugs. And I think being on TV allowed me to basically tell my story and come clean, because in my sick thinking, even though my track record says I am a full-blown addict and alcoholic, I still had a denial, or I still didn't want to come out and admit that. I didn't want to admit that to myself, so I definitely didn't want to admit it to others. At the time, I was ready, truly ready to surrender to this disease. Gave me an opportunity and gave me a stage where I can admit to the world that this is who I am and this is who I'm going to be the rest of my life, but hopefully I'm just not going to be active in the addiction.
I mentioned that Doc is not an easy or a comfortable book to read. Was it also a hard book to write?
It was tough at times. It was a lot of tears writing that book, like we just mentioned, talking about missing the parade, talking about the first time I did it, about missing my kids' birthdays and school activities, going to prison, being suspended from baseball, isolating from my family for 3 months, and being stuck in a hotel. While I was writing those things, it was very painful, but at the same time, it was very therapeutic where I got a lot out of it. It was a big burden off of me once I was able to put that on paper and talk about it. And also in the book, it was a lot of joy about talking about my career, talking about situations where I've helped others. And the journey that I'm on now, and talking about where I'm at today, was the biggest thing and the most joy I got out of that. And my whole thing was, I got a lot of therapy out of this book, and I hope that somebody can read it and they get to understand how it all unwinded for myself and how also I was feeling during my glory days. And also the most important thing is hopefully this can help someone else that may be going through similar situations or may know someone that's going through similar situations, because drugs is a very powerful thing. And as I put in the book, it basically became my number one priority in my life. It was that much power, and I was that powerless over it.
Tell us a little bit about your current circumstances and your health and what you're doing to hold on to that sobriety.
My health is great right now, and as I write in the book, the things that keep me going, I have to have my foundation. Obviously, I'm a big believer in Christ, a big believer in AA and NA, which I do. I go to meetings. I stay in contact with my sponsor as well as someone in my support group. I help coach my 8-year-old's baseball team as much as I can. I help, you know, deal with the youth programs as much as I can. I go to schools. I go to correctional centers for the youth and just basically tell my story and hopefully be there for them. I do work with the Mets and Yankees more on the corporate side, and that's my joy, and as well as spend a lot of time with my kids and being involved in their activities, whether it's at school or sports.
Doc, A Memoir is the story of Dwight Gooden's baseball career and his battle with addiction. Dwight Gooden, it's been a pleasure to speak to you again, and I wish you the best going forward.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. Thanks for having me.
Do you have good memories of watching Doc Gooden pitch in the 80s and the 90s? If so, please tell us about them by visiting our Facebook page, facebook.com/onlyagameradio. That's facebook.com/onlyagameradio.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals serving global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Eton, offering the American Red Cross radio line, a portable solar-powered radio with cell phone charger and flashlight for emergencies or travel. Now at Best Buy. This is NPR.
Eons ago, as time is measured in video game units, Atari paid Steven Spielberg tens of millions of dollars for the right to develop a little number based on E.T. Gamers hated it. Some labeled it the worst video game of all time. Others ignored it, which is worse. Urban legend has it that in 1983, Atari attempted to bury the embarrassment literally by burying the cartridges. They dumped 9 truckloads of the turkey into a landfill in New Mexico. This week, for reasons that remain obscure, a Canadian studio called Fuel Industries obtained permission to search the landfill in an attempt to locate and resurrect the E.T. game. Why? Did somebody high up at Fuel Industries hear a mysterious call to rescue poor E.T.? I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, whistling while you're working at winning. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie. I could see that coming.
Oh, hi.
That's
hi, Bill.
Fine.
Hi, what's up? Okay.
We have not spoken about what fun it would be for fans of old-timey hockey if the Stanley Cup Finals matched 2 original 6 teams. How does Blackhawks/Bruins sound to you?
What? It sounds fine to me. It's remarkable to me that we haven't had an original 6 matchup in 34 years. That's really astonishing. First of all, got to go back to the sweaters. None of this modern breathable fabric. Got to go back to the sweaters.
Next, you'll suggest no masks on the goalies.
No. Got to have the masks on the goalies, and got to have the helmets too. I want like aesthetic nostalgia, not dangerous medical nostalgia.
Okay. Speaking of the playoffs, Charlie, when was the last time you saw a hockey player continue trying to block shots after successfully blocking one got him a broken leg?
Yeah, that's Gregory Campbell of the Bruins, who, by the way, will never have to pay for a beer in the city of Boston ever again in his life. I mean, that's what hockey players do. That's what hockey players do, absolutely.
The San Antonio Spurs took the first game of the NBA Finals. Will the Miami Heat rally and successfully defend their title?
I hope so. I hope they rally and we get a series out of this. But I'll tell you what, the San Antonio Spurs are competitively about the toughest team we have in any sport anywhere right now. And Tony Parker, the shot that sealed the game where he got up off the floor and got it up in the air and beat the shot clock going through LeBron James's arm, that's one you're going to see in highlight reels for 100 years. I mean, the only thing better than that would be if he had broken his leg or something.
Jason Kidd and Grant Hill both retired this week, and so the average age of NBA players dropped by, what, 7 or 8 years?
They were co-rookies of the year. They were picked second and third in the draft in 1994, and they retired in the same week. It's really quite remarkable.
The Toronto Raptors are under new management, Charlie, and the new management has been making noises about changing the team's name. Have any suggestions for them?
Well, going back now, because we do like to do a little history here on Only a Game, the names that were suggested prior to them settling on Raptors included Hogs, Beavers, Terriers, Bobcats, taken now, T-Rex, awful, Tarantulas, worse, Scorpions, getting even worse than that, Dragons, okay, and Grizzlies, which is taken now. So I shudder to think what they're going to come up with on their second try.
Alex Rodriguez is one of a score of players allegedly connected to the defunct Biogenesis Clinic in Florida. Biogenesis founder Tony Bosch announced this week that he would cooperate with Major League Baseball's ongoing investigation. How does this compare to the Balco fiasco and baseball's various other steroid embarrassments?
I think it's exactly the same thing, because you finally got a sleazy, weasel-speaking canary to talk, and now we're going to have another whole year or two of outrage, and then we'll maybe even produce a couple of more criminal trials that will go nowhere and will waste a lot of money.
Meanwhile, Ohio State is finally going to do something about updating that ridiculously inadequate venue in which their football team has been playing.
They forced out their president this week, so they've got a little bit of room to spare up there. Yeah, they're going to expand the stadium to 104,829, which will bump them up to third place over Neyland Stadium in the Let's Put More Seats arms race in college football.
Yeah, it only had 102,000 seats.
What's that extra 2,000 that's going to make all the difference?
And as you mentioned, speaking of Ohio State, they are looking for a president. Hey, listeners, if you want to be a university president, get your resume in now.
And don't mouth off about Notre Dame, because that will always get you in big trouble.
According to FIFA's latest rankings, which came out this week, Brazil's national men's team is number 22 in the world. Brazil had never been out of the top 20 until this week. So do you suppose more people than ever before now regard FIFA as a silly organization?
Well, now you know FIFA, so you tell me. Is the reason that Brazil has dropped all the way to 22nd in the ranking the fact that their check hasn't cleared yet, or what?
It sounds right. I'm not sure.
I refuse to believe that Ecuador, Croatia, and Belgium are all better than Brazil. I will not believe that. Even with little I know about international soccer, I won't believe that.
Do you think people who've thought that they might like to be world-class athletes may want to reconsider when they hear what happened to champion skier Lindsey Vonn while she was attending the Council of Fashion Designers of America Awards at Lincoln Center in New York on Monday night?
Isn't the war on drugs a wonderful thing, Bill? Doesn't it make you proud to be an American? The U.S. Anti-Doping Agency urine police showed up in the middle of this banquet and dragged her off to be randomly tested in the middle of it. I simply wouldn't do it. I would call the security at whatever hotel it was and have the urine police escorted to the sidewalk as rudely as possible.
Former national swimming champion and Hollywood star Esther Williams died on Thursday. Have you a favorite Esther Williams movie?
A favorite Esther Williams movie?
She made a lot of movies.
And I've seen none of them.
She dove from heights.
All I know is that every movie she emerges from the pool. And
wet.
There are other lovely mermaids who come out of the pool in this music. When I was a kid, Esther Williams was a cultural touchstone. Mm-hmm. Any woman who swam would say, "Hey, who do you think you are, Esther Williams?" So that's what I know about Esther Williams, and the fact she was married to Fernando Lamas for a while. But other than that, I have never seen an Esther Williams movie.
I don't believe you.
I have never seen one. I did not even see the movie she made with Fernando Lamas, in which they fell in love, called Dangerous When Wet.
And finally,
sports!
Father's Day is coming up, and I hope none of Jack Nicholson's children are planning on giving him a set of golf clubs, because if they are, they're too late.
Yeah, Jack bought a set made by a Japanese company called Honma. They cost $75,000. It took 100 people to make these clubs, and they are made out of platinum and 24-karat gold. And you know what? If you knock them against a root when you're trying to get your ball out of the rough, it won't matter. It will chip anyway.
Yeah, and it's a $12,000 repair on that meshy niblet.
Exactly right. Because you're not going to go to the pro shop and say, "Please, can you give a slab of 24-karat gold to fix my four iron?"
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Grantland, among other places, and he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you, Bill.
Hey, big spender. Hey, big spender. Hey, big spender. Spend a little time with me.
Tom Perrotta writes about tennis. While covering the 2013 French Open for the Wall Street Journal, Tom has written about familiar names such as Roger Federer, Rafael Nadal, and Serena Williams. But he's also brought us the story of 12-year-old Adam Neff, and that's the story that caught my attention. Tom, Adam trains on a red clay court, not in Paris, but in Bradenton, Florida. Can you tell me about that court and the facility that surrounds it?
Yes, the facility's in his backyard. His parents built it in the last few years. He has a red clay court. He has a hard court that's like the courts they use at the Sony Open in Miami, and they're building a U.S. Open replica hard court, too. And he also has a gym and lots of equipment like a CVAC pod and all sorts of high-tech stuff to help his development.
All right, time out. A CVAC pod where he allegedly spends up to an hour a day. What is a CVAC pod?
A CVAC pod is a very new thing. I can't say that I absolutely 100% understand it, though I did try it out to see what it was like. The theory is that, you know, it benefits your blood's ability to take in oxygen and recover better. I went in it for a little while just to try it out, and, you know, your ears pop a lot. That's about all you notice.
You didn't notice that you became a better tennis player?
I was in there for, I did 2 5-minute sessions, which you have to start with, and no, I didn't become any better at tennis.
Why did Guy and Ann Neff, 12-year-old Adam's parents, decide to build this facility in the backyard?
It's an interesting situation. I've not seen anything quite like it. Going to a tennis academy is very expensive, and I think this in some ways actually turns out to be a financially smarter move because they live pretty far out in Bradenton. They're not really close to anything. They've got a lot of land. The cost of sending one kid to an academy and perhaps another, because they have a daughter who plays and a younger daughter who might play too, can really add up fast, and they really didn't want him living away from home.
I understand that when you were speaking with Adam's family, his father said, he's my buddy. I don't want him to be going off to an academy, even though there is an academy or six within the same sort of general area code.
Yeah, there are some close by. He could commute there, if you're talking about Balotelli's Academy, which is not all that far away. That sort of changes the dynamic of the academy, though, somewhat. A lot of those places would prefer, especially if you're a top player, prefer that you live there and you're getting, you know, attention from them all the time. And they also looked at an academy in Europe. But, you know, it's always a tough choice. Every top player, you know, almost all of them, Djokovic is the best player in the world now, Andy Murray, lots of them have gone to live somewhere else at what amounts to a pretty young age, 14, 15, 16. And maybe someday, you know, he'll have to do that because he'll need more practice partners. But the hope is that with this, he can stay home and they can bring people in to play, you know, where he is rather than him going somewhere else.
Is young Adam good enough to warrant all this training and attention in this facility?
I think you can ask that question about anyone. Is anyone good enough? You know, I mean, he's one of the two best, if not the very best, 12 and under player in the country. He's quite a good player. That doesn't always mean you're going to be a professional or the best player at 18. There's lots of kids who've been that good at that age that didn't become great pros, so it's very hard to tell.
When you spoke with Adam, he told you that he would like to become the number one tennis player in the world someday. Were you able to get a sense of whether that was really his goal, or was that the goal that his parents had for him?
In all this, I was struck by how much it really does seem to be his goal and not his parents' goal. His parents weren't tennis players. They're doctors. They're very well educated. They're very into his education. They really stress that. And the kid is a very mature kid for his age. Speaks well, very bright, and really is into it. I mean, I saw them for a day and a half. It's hard to really learn much about a person in a day and a half, but he has a lot of fun on the court.
Tom Perrotta is a contributor to the Wall Street Journal. Tom, thank you very much for joining me.
Oh, anytime. Thanks for having me.
Successful athletes require good hand-eye coordination. Ron Schachter recently visited Lewisburg, North Carolina for a championship that requires good ear-lip coordination. He realized he wasn't covering just any competition when he saw a custom license plate that spelled the word pucker.
More than 60 contestants from a dozen states and half a dozen foreign countries competed at this year's International Whistlers Convention. For 40 years, serious whistlers have come to the campus of Lewisburg College every spring. The competition is spread over 3 days to accommodate an elimination round and the finals in the junior, teenage, and adult divisions. The Whistlers offer up a classical and a popular piece. And while there are prizes in each genre, the most coveted is the Grand Championship covering both performances. Chris Ullman, a four-time grand champion in the adult division, served as a competition judge this time around. He explains that whistling winners need multiple skills, including technical ability, musical interpretation, and stage presence.
Well, you've got to have all three. If you want to be a champ, it's like being a golfer. You've got to have a good drive, you got to have a good short game, you got to be able to get out of the bunker.
Ullman also suggests a training regimen, which includes no kissing for 24 hours before taking the stage.
You want to keep the lips kind of crisp, not mushy. Kissing makes lips mushy. I sip ice water right before the performance. And then the ice actually helps constrict the tissue on your lips to keep the surface smooth, because you want the air traveling through to be very smooth. You don't want it to be rough at all, because that can affect kind of the quality of the sound.
There are pitfalls peculiar to whistling. Carol Ann Kaufman has been coming here from California for the past 12 years.
It never fails, it seems. Whenever we're here at the competition, we're all complaining about dry mouth. And, I'm sure it has something to do with travel, but I think it has more to do with nerves. It's funny, I can get through whole shows without a sip of water, but I can barely get through a song here at the IWC sometimes without a sip.
Okay. Our next competitor is from Qingdao in China, and he will be performing Rondo a la Turk by Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. Please welcome Gao Qingyu.
In this year's classical competition, kids and adults alike tackle Mozart, Tchaikovsky, and Shostakovich. Kaufman offers up an aria from a Bizet opera. International contingent included competitors from Canada, Spain, and Russia. Most came from Japan and China, where the International Whistlers Convention was held in 2008 and 2010, respectively. In Japan, even though women traditionally are discouraged from whistling, younger performers are establishing their own tradition.
Fourteen-year-old
Marina Gatto says that although she's always whistled at home while washing the dishes, she's been a competitive whistler for less than a year. Gatto, who won this year's grand championship in the female teen division, adds that she likes using her body as an instrument, which makes a beautiful sound. That includes warbling, which she's happy to demonstrate. Some of the winners here go on to fame, if not fortune, performing for the Jay Leno Show, with symphony orchestras, and on albums. Carol Ann Kaufman, who calls herself a whistling activist, has a larger agenda.
Whistling was popular back in the 40s and even before, and it did sort of wane out. People forgot that it's a world-class instrument. And I will tell you this, every time I perform for someone, minds get blown. And people experience music in a way they never did before, and they get a new respect for whistling as an art form. And that is absolutely a huge payoff.
Kaufman, who finished third in the adult women's competition of this year's championships, and many of her fellow competitors will be back next year to celebrate their annual rite of spring and to breathe new life into mankind's first musical instrument. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter.
If you'd like to pay lip service to Ron Schachter's whistling photos, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Jasper Wilson, and we had help this week from Martin Kessler. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word comes from Hollywood legend Lauren Bacall, who was also a whistling coach.
You just put your lips together and...
All right. It's a family show here. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
Support comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Details are at gatesfoundation.org. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness. On the web at melvilletrust.org. And the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world. On the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.